cause damage or to a deeper muscular structure.
In what circumstances do you see this in other cases?
This is a very classic injury in strangulation.
And what is shown then in exhibits 42 and 43?
42 and 43 show petechiae or pinpoint hemorrhages involving the white of the eye and the inner lining of the lower eyelid.
What's the significance of those findings?
These are, again, a very classic finding in strangulation cases.
Explain the process that results in this finding.
The formation of petechiae indicate that there has been disruption and interruption of blood flow from the heart to or from the head. Generally speaking, it would also tend to indicate that this process of disruption is intermittent rather than a complete cessation without relaxation. And again, more consistent with strangulation where there is struggling.
Are these clearly pre-mortem injuries?
Yes.
And when I ask that question, does that also include the neck hemorrhage and the bruising on the neck?
Yes.
In your opinion, Dr. Gray, did the strangulation event contribute to Sunamu's death?
Yes.
And it was one of many things that contributed to her death?
Yes.
Assuming that the strangulation was intermittent and that she was still alive after the strangulation occurred, what would she have been feeling?
If she is still conscious, she would have felt pain in her neck. Her voice may have been hoarse. Whether she would have felt other symptoms from her brain anoxia or lack of oxygen to the brain, I can't say.
Would the lack of circulation to her brain, even if it was for short periods of time, be relevant to the swelling of the brain that you testified about earlier?
Yes.
Explain that, if you would.
The brain has a very limited repertoire of response to any kind of an insult. A blow to the brain can lead to swelling. A lack of oxygen can lead to swelling. Certain types of intoxications can lead to swelling. So the fact that I found cerebral edema or swelling of the brain, I cannot tease out whether that was from the blunt force trauma to the head or from the anoxia or lack of oxygen in the strangulation, or a combination of the two with who knows what distribution of responsibility.
Now, during the autopsy process, Dr. Frazier was actually there for a period of time. Is that right? Not during the autopsy itself, but shortly after.
She arrived shortly after our exam and then did her colposcopic examination, yes.
Were you present when she did that examination?
Yes, not for the full time, but for part of the exam.
And did you have a chance to see what she was seeing?
Yes.
Let's see if I can. Let's put that one up. What was it that you personally observed?
In terms of the findings in the
yes.
genital area, there was what appeared to be petechial contusion of the periurethral tissues around the outlet for urine. There was also a petechial contusion of the hymen.
Were these things that you had found in your gross autopsy examination?
No, it became much more obvious and clear with the magnification and illumination of the colposcope.
Do you generally use a colposcope as
you
do?
No, I do not.
Did you discuss the findings that Dr. Frazier made with her?
Yes.
And did you concur in her findings? Her
conclusion? That there was evidence of tissue damage in those areas, yes.
Were you able to form your own opinion as to whether that evidence of tissue damage was pre-mortem?
The finding of bruising, and particularly petechial bruising, would, to my mind, indicate again that whatever caused that trauma happened while there was blood pressure.
Do you have an opinion as to what the little girl would have felt as that trauma was being applied?
I would, again, presume that it would be painful.
Well, let's move on then to the injuries to the little girl's heart. What's shown in Exhibit 44?
This is a photograph taken at the time of the examination showing that when we open the pericardial sac that contains the heart, this is the heart, it is filled with blood. And that, as I said, accumulated to approximately 80 cc's and resulted from a tear of the right atrium, or the first chamber of the heart where blood returns from the body.
What else were you able to determine from that finding? Were you able to determine what type of force would have been required to cause that tear?
Yes. This is, again, consistent with the application of blunt force, and it probably happened in the process of the heart cycle where the atrium was most filled with blood. So essentially you apply force and it's like hitting a water balloon. It can pop.
And you explained earlier that when the pericardium is intact, it's a worse situation for the person involved.
Yes, because the blood doesn't have anywhere to go, so it fills that sac. As it fills the sac, the ability of the heart to expand and fill with blood is compromised because there's no space left.
In your opinion, what likely resulted in this particular tear to this little girl?
I'd object to the form of the question with what likely resulted.
Yeah, I don't understand the question, so.
Nor do I.
Okay. Try it a different way.
Stained.
What was the significance of the amount of blood that you found?
That would be potentially lethal in and of itself.
After the injury occurred, how long did she have to live?
Given that the laceration was not very large, so the accumulation of blood wasn't as fast as if we had a very big tear, but still probably this could result in death in a matter of minutes.
If this injury had occurred prior to all the others you've talked about, would that be consistent, or is it more likely this happened after the others?
I would expect that this injury was sustained much more towards the end of whatever process led to all of the injuries that I've documented.
As to the entire collection of the injuries that you've testified about, would that have taken some duration of time to cause?
Yes.
Any estimate of how long?
I don't know. You tell me how savage and frenzied the attack was. That might tell you how long it goes on.
Are you able to say, as a result of these various types of injuries, how many episodes of trauma she went through before her ultimate death?
Not objective speculation.
In your opinion, Dr. Gray, would this entire collection of injuries be consistent with the little girl falling down the stairs?
No.
Explain why not.
The mechanism of injury in a fall downstairs really sort of does depend on the mechanics of the fall. To sustain multiple injuries in multiple parts of the body in various planes, either front, side, back, would require a prolonged tumbling kind of a fall. That type of a fall may certainly lead to multiple external injuries, but it doesn't generate the kinds of force that I believe would be necessary to cause the very severe internal damage that I found, both in the head and the torso.
To your knowledge, sorry.
Conversely, if it was a more like a fall from a height without any tumble or twist, and a single terminal impact, yes, that might be able to cause the head injury. Might in and of itself cause torso injuries, but it would not be able to cause the multiplicity of injuries that I see externally.
That's all I have here.
Do you want me to forge ahead before lunch?
Sure. Let's get going. What do you anticipate this afternoon? You have one more doctor?
We have the person from the crime lab that did the serology and DNA, and that's all.
And how long do you think that will take?
I would anticipate probably about the same that we've done with each of these witnesses.
Okay, Mr. Peterson, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Dr. Gray, it's good to see you again. You said during your direct examination that an autopsy will involve a careful external exam and a careful internal exam relative to the body or subject in question, correct?
Yes.
You'll have to bear with me while I attempt to slow myself down. For the interpreter. Does that autopsy exam also need to take into account the environment in which the deceased body is found?
Yes.
In this particular case, were the conditions of the environment taken into account as you conducted your autopsy?
I guess I need to know more specifically what you're referring to.
Okay. Your Honor, if I may approach the witness, please.
You may.
I'm showing you two pages that I believe come from
your medical examiner's report. Can you identify what those documents are?
These are Two pages of the investigative report submitted by my investigator, Brent Marchant.
Would you say that name again, Brent?
Brent Marchant, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-T.
Thank you.
And these are the notations on this document. Essentially are generated through a database that fills in the various headings, and that would be information that Mr. Marchant would have entered into the computer.
Okay. So these two pages, and for the record, Judge, I've marked this as Defendant's Exhibit Number 2, just for identification. These notations and information contained in the two pages, Doctor, come from Brent Marchant in this case and not from you at all?
Nothing on this I would have entered at this point, no.
Nothing you would have entered?
Not at this point.
On these two pages?
No.
Okay. So back to my question then, Doctor, with regard to the circumstances of the scene where the girl's body was found by law enforcement. I'd first like to go to that heading labeled scene in the bottom left-hand portion of the first page, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
The indication there is Office of Medical Examiner MD at the scene,
mm-hmm.
TCG. I assume that's Todd Gray.
Todd C. Gray, yes.
So you arrived at the scene?
I do not have an independent recollection of doing that, so I'm not sure if that was a mistake of Brent's or not. I just cannot remember.
You do not remember
going to the scene,
being in the basement, seeing the shower, looking at the stairs firsthand?
I don't remember doing that, no.
Brent is generally precise and thorough in his reporting, in your experience?
Yes. Does it make data entry errors sometimes? Yes.
So you could have been there, but no memory.
I don't think I did. This was a pretty high profile case. I probably wouldn't remember going to the scene. I don't remember going to the scene. The way that name, those initials could have shown up in that box is my name was given as the examining physician, and this was a computer fill-in, not a conscious entry by Brent.
Moving on, Doctor, with regard to the scene designation, on the upper right portion of page 1, there's an indication under the heading lividity of fixed.
Yes.
Tell the court the significance of that.
As I described in my direct testimony, lividity is the settling of blood with gravity after death. In the initial postmortem period, if you push the skin in an area where there is lividity, you will see it blanch. So that the blood is pushed away from where that pressure is. Later on in the postmortem period, the lividity becomes fixed, meaning that if you push on it, you're not going to see that pushing away or blanching. So that indication of fixed lividity at the time Brent looked at the body at the scene would indicate that the postmortem interval was longer rather than shorter.
Right. And so, generally speaking, Doctor, how long from the moment of death until lividity is fixed?
It's variable.
Right.
It depends on a number of different factors. Generally speaking, lividity will become fixed anywhere from 6 to 10 hours after death.
Could it be shorter than that based on temperature and environment?
Shorter, possible. More likely, it may be extended rather than shorter.
Let's assume a very cool to cold environment that the body's in, face down on cold tile in a shower. What would you expect for fixed lividity in a situation like that?
I would be surprised if that condition, those conditions that you describe, necessarily really affect lividity. They certainly would affect rigor or the stiffening of the muscles after death. In and of itself, keeping the body cool and on a tile or concrete surface, I don't think that would change with the progress of lividity.
Okay. So on to the next point you've raised, then, the rigor. The finding here, as I understand it on the top of page 2, is rigor was hard.
Correct.
What's the significance of that?
That would, again, indicate that the process of formation of rigor or the stiffening of the muscles after death was more advanced rather than less advanced. At first, after death, the limbs remain floppy. As time goes by, you begin to appreciate stiffness, and eventually that may reach a maximum so that the limb is essentially hard. Generally speaking, the development of rigor is going to take about 8 to 12 hours to become hard. That is much, much more affected by things like temperature.
Isn't it true, Doctor, that rigor can in fact set in a much shorter time frame than what you just indicated?
There are reports of what is called cadaveric spasm that appears to be almost instantaneous rigor, or at least hardness fixed contracture of muscles in some instances, yes.
So can you give a rough time window for rigor in a case like this?
It really is dependent upon both the environment in which the body rests, as well as both endogenous factors in the body.
Meaning?
Such as temperature. Someone who is very hot at the time of death may develop, I've seen rigor become fully fixed in a person who is quite febrile within a matter of 4 hours.
By febrile you mean?
Hot. Degree of physical activity prior to death may affect how fast rigor develops. Someone who is running and fighting for their life is certainly going to develop rigor faster than someone who dies quietly in bed without struggle. Can I tell you with any degree of certainty that I know how fast this little girl developed rigor? No.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not after that specific opinion. I'm really just after the general window, time frame window, if you can give it to us.
Okay. As I said, a hot, febrile individual can develop it, or a person who's in a very warm, hot environment will develop it much faster. 4 hours to have full rigor possible if those conditions are met. Someone who is in a cold environment, their rigor is going to develop slower. So could it go out to 14, 16 hours? Certainly possible. I cannot tell you for sure in this case.
Right. So you've already stated, Doctor, that the temperature of the individual, the surrounding circumstances, temperature of the environment are important factors, right?
Yes.
In this particular report, when we look at the scene investigation notes, under the heading body temperature, it's blank.
Right.
That's a problem, right?
It's a piece of information that would have been helpful that isn't going to change much, as far as I'm concerned.
And similarly, the ambient room temperature, that indication on the form is blank, correct?
That is correct.
Again, some important information we would like to have here.
It'd be a piece of information that could be used that is not, in my mind, crucial in terms of determining how this person died.
Certainly not how necessarily, Doctor, but when is part of your task when you do an autopsy, right?
It's one of the questions we try to provide some answers to, but I would never say that I could say for sure in an unwitnessed death when somebody died.
No. As long as we're on that narrow topic, Doctor, in this particular case, with the information that you have from the sources that provided you the search information, the information from your autopsy, is it your medical opinion this little girl could have died anywhere from March 31st afternoonish to sometime on April 1st?
Yes.
And we can't narrow it down any more than that based on your findings.
I can.
Doctor, do you have the copy of the death certificate there before you?
Oh, in my file I have my original, yes.
Judge, may I approach?
You may.
I'll make it easier for you, though. I have pre-marked what's labeled Defense Exhibit 3 for identification. Please tell us what that is.
This is a copy of the death certificate with the medical information filled in, which is, would have been done by us, the medical examiner's office.
Right. Now, just so the record's clear about this document, in the upper right-hand portion, you indicate date of death as April 1st, 2008.
I indicate that the date of death was April 1st, 2008, when the body was found.
Right.
And that is our standard procedure. We will not attempt to say we know for sure when somebody died if that death was not witnessed, and we will put date of death as the found date and the time of death as the found date.
Okay. And similarly, on the very top, Doctor, of your report of examination, the same indication there, April 1st, 2008, for date of death, for the same reason you just gave.
That's correct.
Moving on, though, Doctor, in the death certificate itself, the indication here in the middle of the page under immediate cause are all the causes you've just testified to on direct examination. You see that?
Essentially a summation of all that I've testified described as blunt force injuries of head, neck, torso, and muscles.
Right. But as you move further to the right under section 24 of this death certificate, there's a space for the interval and onset. Tell the court what the significance of that section of the report is.
That is designed for physicians to try to record or say how long it took a certain process of death to develop.
And it's left blank, correct?
Yes.
Why?
Because I don't know.
Okay. Tell us why you don't know.
Because I don't know if I should put 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. I do not know how long that process of injury occurred.
And based on your medical findings during the autopsy, you can't narrow it between 1 minute to 30 minutes?
To a couple hours? Right. I cannot. No.
Doctor, under part two of section 24, on the death certificate, there's a question there about conditions that contribute to the death.
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Right. So I was just doing that for the court's benefit. I apologize. Can you tell me what, if anything, you deem pertinent to put in that section?
If I find some other findings that are independent and unrelated to the process that I say caused death in part one, but which I think are of significance and may have contributed or sped death in some way, that's where I would put that notation.
Right. And what did you know about any of that information for inclusion in that part of the report?
I didn't find anything in terms of the autopsy that I thought would warrant inclusion in there.
Okay. Doctor, for a moment, going back to the initial exhibit, the report of investigation marked Defense Exhibit 1 for identification. Do you have that in front of you?
No.
It's off to your far right.
That's 2.
Oh. If I may approach, Judge.
I just need to get my exhibit number. Okay. I apologize. Number 2. Could you please look at page 2 of number 2?
There's a heading for medical history. Do you see that?
Yes.
The indication is there were no known medical conditions, right?
That is correct.
And no known prescriptions, right?
That is correct.
Did you endeavor to get a medical history of Surnamu while you were doing your autopsy?
No.
Why not?
Because I didn't find anything that made me think she was being treated for any important conditions.
Okay. So no one informed you through the family that she had a significant asthma condition?
I did not know about that. No.
No one informed you through the family that she was using an inhaler for that significant asthma condition?
No.
Well, let's go back to the death certificate for a minute then. Under part 24, subpart 2, let's assume that that's accurate, that you know about a significant asthma condition and the use of an inhaler medication. Do you put that there on part 2?
Not unless I saw evidence that made me believe that she was suffering an acute asthma attack that may have led or contributed to her death.
What can cause an acute asthma attack, Doctor?
Number of things. External factors like allergens or other airway irritants. Internal factors such as stress may bring on an acute asthma attack.
Let's assume a little girl is struck, feels like she's under attack, and has an asthma condition. Can that cause an asthma attack?
It might.
And can that asthma attack then become severe enough to cut off airways?
Yes.
And can that cut off of airways then produce some of the edema in the brain you've testified about?
Certainly.
So it could be very significant for you to know.
If there was evidence that you would have suffered an acute asthma attack, yes.
Right. Well, let's talk about that evidence, Doctor. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that we actually have the edema in the brain, the swelling that you indicated on direct, can come from a lack of oxygen.
Yes. But
that could be attributable to asthma, right?
As I stated, that is a non-specific reaction of the brain to an insult. It does not prove or show that asthma, an inability to breathe due to asthma caused that edema. No.
No, I'm not suggesting that it definitively proves that, Doctor. I'm just talking about some possibilities here.
Yes. Could cerebral edema result from an acute asthma attack and difficulty oxygenating the blood? Certainly.
And could the acute asthma attack cutting off airway, causing that kind of edema in the brain, lead to unconsciousness?
Yes.
You talk generally on direct examination about levels of pain that the little girl may have experienced. I just want to be clear, Doctor, that the pain you're talking about in any instance assumes consciousness, right?
Yes.
So if we had a severe asthma attack, cutting off airways and rendering an individual unconscious, a lot of the pain observations you make might not have existed in this case.
Those descriptions of pain are dependent upon a conscious individual, not an unconscious person.
Doctor, you indicated on direct examination that a homicide is produced by the intentional act of another individual, right?
That is correct.
But you're also familiar with homicides that occur in accidental environments, such as car homicides and or negligent types of homicides that don't involve an intentional act of another.
You are conflating legal determination of homicide and a medical determination.
I do that all the time. I'm sorry.
So in your example of an automobile homicide, someone who, for whatever reason, mismanages the operation of their vehicle and that leads to someone's death, it may have criminal charges, but it is not considered a homicide medically. Someone who uses their car as a weapon and chases down an individual and rolls over them three or four times, we call that a homicide.
Very good. The reason I approached the question the way I did, in terms of ideas of negligence or accident, is because I need to talk to you for a minute about the other part of the environment at the scene, other than where the girl was found in the shower, and that is the stairwell leading to the basement. Were you able to look at crime scene photos of that stairwell, since you don't remember being there?
Yes, I have. I do recall seeing pictures of the stairs.
Okay. I'm going to base some questions on your recollection of those stairs for a minute. Would you like to see them again?
Yeah, if you like. It would be more helpful if I actually have the stairs to look at.
If I may approach,
you may. I'm willing to try to do it by memory, but you may get a lot of, I don't really remember.
Judge, I thought I had labeled that and put it up near the witness stand. Oh, I did label it, but I didn't put it up there yet. May I approach again?
You may.
Doctor, I'm showing you Defendant's Exhibit Number 4, which was a photo provided to me by the District Attorney's Office indicating some crime scene environment. I'll ask if you recognize having seen those stairs before.
Yes.
Does that appear to be the set of stairs we're talking about leading to the downstairs area of the place where the girl was found?
Yes, this appears to be similar to the pictures that I have seen of the apartment and the stairwell.
Okay. As we think about the collection of injuries and traumas that you've just testified about on direct examination, consider two individuals struggling with one another, doctor, who then simultaneously tumble down that particular set of stairs together, and the larger, heavier of the two landing multiple times on the body of the smaller of the two. The constellation of injuries that you've talked about on direct, can we attribute those injuries to that type of blunt force trauma with the larger of the two falling on the smaller numerous times?
Is it possible? I guess it is. It's a very unique concretion of events. The cases I've had where a child was involved in a fall with an adult. The pattern that I have seen, the injury that I have seen that was lethal in those circumstances, tends to be concentrated only into one area of the body, specifically, most often head, sometimes torso. To have enough force generated in a tumbling fall down a very down a relatively narrow stairway like that, and then develop so much force that we see severe injuries of head, chest, abdomen. I have never seen that before. I can't say it's impossible, but it's pretty unique.
Okay. I need to talk to you for just a minute, Doctor, about the position of the body when it was found down in the shower stall.
May I approach the witness, Your Honor?
You may.
I'm showing a little bit more defendant's exhibit 5 just for identification. Have you ever seen that particular crime scene photo before, Doctor?
Yes.
And what are we seeing in that photo?
There's a series of 4 images that show the little girl's body lying in on the floor of a shower stall. Essentially, she's in a somewhat frog leg position, face down.
Right. So you talked to Mr. Parrish about the lividity factor, that is to say, the way in which the blood settles downward with gravity and I guess tends to pool in different areas.
In the dependent areas of the parts of the body that gravity would pull blood down to.
Right. You certainly found some evidence of that type of lividity or blood settling or blood pooling based on the fact that she was facing face down, correct?
Yes, her lividity pattern was anterior over the front surfaces of the body.
If I may approach one more time, Judge.
You may.
I'm showing you what's been marked defense exhibit number 1 for identification, Doctor. And it has basically a front and then one photo on the back.
Okay.
Have you seen those?
Well, actually, these photos, I believe, were generated out of your office. Is that correct?
Some of them appear to have been, they all appear to be taken at my office. Some of them may not have been taken by my staff because they don't have a label with our case number on it, and we will strive mightily to make sure that there's always a picture. All pictures have our label in it. So this may have been taken by a police photographer at the same time we're taking
it. Okay. For the purposes of our discussion, Doctor, the reason I handed those to you is, do those show this blood settling lividity effect on the front part of the little girl's body?
Yes, they do.
Okay. So that's the part of your report I needed to get into. In your medical examiner's report, there's a section at the very end, capital O, on page 2 of your report, where you talk about...
Okay. At the very end, you're going... Well, I'm looking at the microscopics, and I'm going, what?
Okay,
Yeah.
Okay, where you talk about the periurethral and hymenal petechial hemorrhages. Do you see that?
Yes.
Okay. The question I'm driving at here, Doctor, is the lividity or pooling effect, given the position of the body when it was found. Can we account for that kind of petechiae in those areas based on the blood settling or blood pooling?
Not in my opinion, no. And I'll be happy to explain.
Please.
Okay. The hemorrhages that we saw around the urethra and on the hymen were very, very fine pinpoint areas of hemorrhage. And that can happen as a consequence of blood force applied to tissues. We can see it on skin. You can see it in softer tissues. Sometimes in areas of lividity, you may get areas of hemorrhage in the actual portion of the body that has lividity. Those are called tardu hemorrhages, T-A-R-D-I-E-U, hemorrhages. The difference between tardu hemorrhages and petechiae is there tends to be a lot more variation in size and shape of tardu hemorrhages compared to petechial hemorrhages. And to my eye, what I was seeing on the periurethral and hymenal tissues was not consistent with that phenomena of blood vessels popping and releasing blood in an area of lividity, which is what a tardu hemorrhage is.
Okay. So just to clarify your medical opinion about that, are you saying it could possibly be a blood pooling or blood settling effect, but you don't think it is, or are you saying it just is not blood pooling?
It does not look like it. Could it be? Is it possible? Sure, it's possible, but in my mind, extremely unlikely.
Okay. So in that extremely unlikely category, if it's blood pooling or lividity, then we don't have any signs of a sexual assault in this case, right?
Object to that.
Well,
that calls for a legal conclusion.
That's a medical opinion.
Well, I don't think so. That's my objection.
We'll rule. Okay. You can answer it, Doctor.
If the findings around the urethra and the hymen were tardu hemorrhages as opposed to petechial hemorrhage, then you could not conclude that force had been applied to that area of the body. That's the best I can give you.
Okay. In terms of your description, Doctor, under heading O on page 2 of your report, you specifically choose to word it as petechial, correct?
Correct.
As opposed to any other kind of bruising or hemorrhaging like an ecchymosis.
Correct.
And you use that word deliberately, correct?
Yes, because it best described that pattern of injury that I was seeing.
In layman's terms, is the ecchymosis a more severe kind of bruise than a petechiae?
It's a different kind of a bruise. When you have a confluent or uniform bruise, the area sort of has, as I say, a consistent discoloration. A petechial contusion, you see, it's not uncommon in a slap to the face, for example. Instead of seeing that geographic confluent discoloration, you see just a whole bunch of little pinpoint hemorrhages. So it's called a petechial contusion, but it's still indicative of force applied to the tissue.
Well, I guess to say it another way, would you say there's more force applied with the ecchymosis type?
It really does depend on what you see underneath the skin. If I saw a petechial contusion and then lots of muscular hemorrhage underneath it, then I'd say, that was quite a whack. If all I see is a little petechial contusion, nothing under the skin, then I would say that wasn't very severe.
Okay. But the flip side of that question I was really asking is, if you were to use the phrase of ecchymosis, would that indicate more blunt force trauma?
No, would just indicate that the pattern I'm seeing is more of a confluent discoloration.
All right. I think I've got it now. Thank you for your patience. You talked about, on your direct, the brain after it had, you had sort of cleaned it off and just set it by itself.
Well, it was after what we call fixation.
Fixation.
So that after, when the brain first comes out, it's very soft, almost pudding-like. In order to be able to do a more careful examination and sectioning of the brain, we will place it in formaldehyde so that it becomes fixed and firmer. So that picture that showed the top of the brain on a blue towel was after that process of fixation.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was referring to. You talked about indications of trauma to the brain seen in that photo.
Not in that photo. The only ones that I talked about trauma was when we had the picture of the top of the head off and
okay.
the brain still sitting in the base of the skull. And that's where I talked about the thin coating of blood over the right subdural, coating of blood.
Right. I got all of that. But
so
I thought
the only thing I talked about for the fixed brain
yes.
was the fact that it looked a little smoother and flatter.
That's
than
what I was going to get to.
Which was is an indication of edema or swelling of the brain.
Right. That was my question, so thank you very much. When we think about the injuries up in the neck and upper chest area,
mm-hmm.
I know you talked about trauma in that area, but now I need you to change your focus just a little to counterbalance this concept of the asthma and the asthma attack. Because you talked to Mr. Parrish about, in your opinion, strangulation being a possible causing factor or
possible
mechanism to death. And now what I'd like you to do is reassess that opinion for a minute in light of a little girl that has asthma using an inhaler who may have had a full-on asthma attack during this event. How does that change your opinion with regard to your statements?
I have never seen intramuscular hemorrhage on the neck as a consequence of asthma.
No, I understand that part.
Okay.
But now I'm talking to you about reassessing the strangulation finding as it relates to the swelling of the brain.
In relation to swelling of the brain.
Yes, and strangulation as a general causation of death, please.
As we previously explored, and a severe acute asthma attack leading to an inability to breathe could produce anoxia or a lack of blood oxygen in the blood, and that could cause cerebral edema. A asthma attack, I have never seen it cause. Pardon me. As I also said, I've never seen hemorrhage in the neck as a result of an asthma attack. Straining to breathe may cause petechiae of the skin of the face, it may cause petechiae of the eyelids or whites of the eyes. Yes.
So, bottom line, Doctor, would the existence of the asthma and the possible asthma attack change your opinion about strangulation as a contributing factor causing death?
No.
Why not?
Because the findings of petechiae involving the whites of the eye and the lining of the eyelid in conjunction with injury of the skin on the front of the neck, hemorrhage of the musculature of the neck, to my mind, is much, much, much more indicative of a strangulation event than being somehow artifacts of an asthma attack.
As you look at the overall global constellation of traumas here and the aftermaths of the traumas in your examination, do you pinpoint a central cause of death in this case?
No, in the sense of everything, all of the damage played a role. If you were to ask me, of all of the injuries that we saw, what is the most lethal? I would certainly say the atrial laceration and the filling of the pericardium with blood. If that was the only thing this girl had, that would have killed her.
You talked about that aspect of your findings on direct and said that you believed or opined that that event, that atrial laceration, occurred late in the series of events or series of traumas. Why?
Because it would be the most rapidly lethal of her injuries. If that had happened at the beginning of the process of all of the injuries that we documented, I would expect that I would start seeing, I would lose evidence of this person having blood pressure when later injuries occurred because she stopped, her heart stopped.
You may have just a moment, Jeff.
Okay, we're going to break for lunch now. I think she would like a break. I would like a break. And the rest of you probably would like one too. How much more would you have on your redirect?
I have about 5 questions.
Okay, I'll give them to you right now so we can get them out of here.
Sure, I think that would be helpful. As to the timing of death, as to when Sunamu actually passed away, I'll ask the question I asked earlier, but now in light of everything you've testified, is there any finding you made that's inconsistent with her having passed away the afternoon of March 31st?
No.
How soon after the injury to her heart, the tear of the atrium of her heart, would she have been dead?
I can't say with certainty, but I would expect within minutes.
Did you find any evidence that she actually suffered a severe asthma attack?
No.
Would there have been some evidence of that?
Yes.
Explain.
With fatal asthma attacks or potentially lethal asthma attacks, what happens is you get an ability to breathe in, but not an ability to breathe out. Your airways are constricted, and air gets in but cannot be expelled. What you tend to see in the lungs of someone who has died of a lethal asthma attack is these very large, hyperinflated, pillowy lungs. You may also see evidence of mucus plugging in the small airways. That is one of the reasons for that ball valve effect. I did not see any findings, either grossly with my naked eye or under the microscope, that made me think this is a person suffering from a severe asthma.
One last question, Dr. Gray. Would you say from the entire evidence that you've reviewed that there was clear evidence of a struggle that Sunamu went through before her death?
I'd object. That's based on speculation.
Overruled it being answered.
I guess I don't know what you mean by a struggle. In my opinion, this is a little girl that was badly beaten. The degree to which she may have fought back, I cannot say. I did not see clear evidence of what I would have called defensive injury. Doesn't mean that she didn't fight back, but I just did not see injuries that I could say this is indicative of a person trying to protect themselves from an attack.
That's all I have.
Go ahead.
Doctor, if you had been informed about the asthma condition, the use of the inhaler, would that have changed the way you focused in on the lung examination in this case?
Well, I would have been thinking, am I going to see anything that proves this diagnosis? So I would have certainly been interested in seeing if I could confirm the clinical history with pathologic diagnoses. Did I not do something that I would have done if I'd known about asthma previously? No, there's no change.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Gray, you're excused.